Jorgen asked.
No. She's an old woman with an excellent taste in pies.
Chapter 19. I bolted awake to Embot panicking.
Spensa! He cried. Spensa!
My heart suddenly pounding, I scrambled to get into position in the cockpit. I grabbed the control sphere, blinking bleary eyes, my thumb on the trigger.
What? I said. Who do I shoot? Someone is in the embassy,
Embot said.
I set up proximity alerts. They're sneaking up on where they think you're sleeping.
Scud! Assassins? Sweating, my mind still cloudy from sleep, I powered up my ship and paused. Then, what? Fly away? To where? I was completely in the clutches of the superiority. If they wanted me dead, they wouldn't resort to assassins, would they? I needed to know more. Determined, I fumbled in the cockpit's small weapons locker and got out my handheld destructor pistol. So far as I'd been able to tell, personal weapons were forbidden on Starsight. But I also appeared to have some diplomatic exemptions, so I wasn't certain where I stood. I made sure my hologram was still active, then quietly cracked the canopy and slipped out, keeping a low profile in case of snipers. I dashed to the steps down into the embassy. Here, I crept down toward the top floor.
There are two of them, Embot said softly through my earpiece. One has reached the kitchen on the top floor. The other is on the bottom floor near the door, perhaps guarding the exit.
Right. I'd never been in any actual ground conflicts, and my training was minimal. However, as I left the stairwell and stepped onto the top floor, I felt the same calm, cold determination that I experienced before a starfighter battle. I could face an assassin, so long as I had a gun in my hand. This was a problem I could shoot. I much preferred it to the nebulous worries I'd fallen asleep to last night.
The enemy is positioned approximately 2 meters inside the door,
Embot whispered to me,
near the counter. Their back is to the door right now. I think they might be surprised you weren't in the bedroom.
I nodded, then leaped into the room, leveling my destructor. A brown, carapaced Krell turned around at the motion, dropping something to the ground that shattered.
A plate?
Ha! The Krell said, the voice being interpreted by my translator as female.
Don't kill me!
What are you doing here? I demanded.
Cleaning your dishes,
the Krell woman said. She waved her armored limbs in a sort of anxious way.
We were sent to do your house cleaning.
House cleaning? I frowned, my gun still leveled. But the Krell woman wore a belt full of cleaning tools on the outside of her sandstone carapace, and through the helmet faceplate, I could see the panicked motions from the shrimpy crab creature. She didn't have any weapons I could see. A sound suddenly came from down below, on the first floor. A vacuum cleaner? Embot said.
Perhaps we misjudged this situation. Such aggression, the Krell cleaner said. I was not warned of this.
Who sent you? I demanded, stepping forward. She cringed back.
We are employed by the Department of Species Integration.
Kuna. I narrowed my eyes, but put away my gun. Sorry about the mistake, I said, then left her and went to check on the other one, a second Krell, who was humming as they vacuumed the ground floor. As I watched them, the chimes at the door rang. I frowned again, then checked the door. A package had been set by it, presumably my new flight suit. Kuna themselves stood outside, tall, blue-skinned, shrouded in an enveloping set of dark blue robes. I opened the door. Kuna gave me one of their creepy smiles, showing too many teeth.
Ah, Emissary Alanik, may I enter?
Did you send your lackeys to sneak up on me? I said. Kuna stopped short.
Lackeys? I'm not familiar with the translation of that word. Minions? I sent Mrs. Chamwit to be your housekeeper, and she brought an assistant. I realized that you didn't bring your own staff and might need some lent to you.
Spies.
I knew it. I found and turned off their surveillance devices, so they sent their agents to the building to watch me. Had I left anything sitting out that would give me away? I hope you find them helpful, Kuna said, checking their communication tablet. I'm a little behind. You're scheduled for pickup in roughly 35 minutes. We wouldn't want you to be late on your first day as a pilot. What do you want from me? I asked, suspicious. And what game are you playing? Only to see that you have an excellent opinion of the superiority to take back to your people, Kuna said. May I enter? I stepped back, reluctantly giving them space to enter. They peeked in at the vacuuming Krell, then strolled to a different meeting room, which was empty. I followed, hovering in the doorway as Kuna sat down. I'm very pleased with your efforts, Alanik, Kuna said, and I apologize for the harrowing experience yesterday. I wasn't aware that Winzik and his kind would use such a dramatic method of selecting their pilots. The Department of Protective Services can be reckless. Yeah, well, I'm not the one who needs your apology, and the ones who do deserve it are all dead at the moment. Indeed, Kuna said. What do you know of the human wars, Alanik of Erdale? I know the humans lost, I said carefully, after dominating my planet and forcing us to fight at their side. A political way of saying it, Kuna replied. Your people will fit in with the superiority far better than some assume. I, however, am known on occasion to defy social customs. Perhaps that is due to my preference for interacting with and learning the habits of species that have not yet joined the superiority. Kuna seemed so tall and aloof. Their voice grew soft, even contemplative, as they continued, turning their heads slightly to gaze out the front window. I'd guess you've never seen the aftermath of a Delver attack. And for that I envy you. They can wipe out all life on a planet just by passing by it, or rather, through it. They don't entirely exist in our reality. They sweep past and leave only silence. What did this have to do with the conversation? We'd been talking about the humans, right? That's terrible, I said. But you told me before that the Delvers left our galaxy centuries ago. So how has anyone seen firsthand what they can do to a planet? Kuna tapped their fingers together, and I realized the answer had stared me in the eyes not a few days before. Standing on the space station outside Detritus, watching that ancient video, I had seen what Delvers could do. The humans summoned a Delver, didn't they? I asked. That's why you're all so frightened of the Delvers, and why you hate humans so much. It wasn't just the wars. The humans tried to weaponize the Delvers. Yes. We nearly lost those wars anyway. But during the second one, the humans developed hidden bases on obscure planets around small or dying stars. There, they began a terrible program. If they'd been successful, then the superiority would have not just been destroyed, it would have vanished. I felt a still coldness deep inside me. The Delver has turned back on us. Words spoken by the man I'd seen on that video, said right before everyone on the planet Detritus had been consumed. I'd watched those long-dead humans try this. That was what they'd been doing. They'd summoned a Delver. Only instead of destroying humankind's enemies, the thing had turned on them. The horror of it welled up in me again, and I felt sick, leaning against the side of the doorframe. We are exceedingly fortunate that their own weapon turned against them, Kuna said. The Delvers cannot be fought or controlled. The humans successfully brought one to our realm, and then it destroyed several of their most important planets and bases. Even after the humans were defeated, this Delver was a scourge upon the galaxy for years until it finally left. I know your people have a reverence for the humans, Alanik. No, you don't need to object. I can understand and empathize to an extent. Yet you must understand that the task we are about here, learning to fight against Delvers, is an essential project. Winsick and I might not agree on how all this should proceed, but we conceived this project together, a way to develop countermeasures against the Delvers. Until we can do this, the superiority is in grave danger. You think the humans are going to return, don't you? I asked, the pieces falling into place. I've read on the local data net that they're supposedly all contained in preserves, but some people claim that the humans are close to escaping. Kuna finally turned from the window to glance at me, their alien expression unreadable. They made a dismissive gesture, sweeping two fingers to the side in front of them. Look back through the archives, and you'll find that the humans are supposedly always close to escaping. Indeed, flare-ups in their resistance always seem to coincide, somehow, with times when the Department of Protective Services needs to pass some important funding bill. That one hit me like a punch to the stomach. The Department of Protective Services, the Krell, they were using Detritus and my people as a way to gain political favor? You think they let the humans grow more dangerous? I said. They maybe relax their guard a little so that everyone will be properly afraid, and so that the department can prove it's doing a good job? I would not make such a claim, Kuna said, for a claim such as that would require evidence, not mere assumption. Let us simply say I find it curious. And it has been happening for so long, so regularly, that I doubt the humans are any kind of real danger to us, no matter what all the experts and commentators think. You're wrong, though, I thought. Winsick made a mistake. He let the DDF get too strong. He let me become a pilot. And now we really are close to breaking out. It's not just a convenient excuse this time. He must be panicking. So now he creates this space force, this special team of pilots. It couldn't be a coincidence. The Delvers are the real danger, Kuna said. Perhaps I am wrong, and perhaps the humans will become a threat again in the future. But even if they do not, someone else will try to use the Delvers. Dealing with Delvers is foolish, reckless, aggressive behavior, and so some race out there is bound to try it. The superiority will not be safe until we can fight the Delvers, or at least drive them away. I can see the logic in that, I said, and I did. My main goal was to steal a hyperdrive, but if there was some superiority weapon against the Delvers that I could discover, then I was certain we'd find that handy as well. But why was Kuna telling me all of this? They rose and stepped closer to me, then glanced at my side, toward the weapon sticking out of my pocket, where I'd hastily stuffed it. I quickly tucked it farther inside. You should not carry that about, Kuna said. You are under my protection, but even that will extend only so far. Sorry, I said. I thought you were... Anyway, I might have frightened the housekeeper upstairs. I'll deal with that, Kuna said. I just need you to understand how important your task is. Winsick must be watched. I do not have the power over this training program that I would like, so I would ask that you remember our deal. I will see that your people's application to the superiority is met with approval. In turn, I would ask you to report to me on your training. I'm to be your spy, I said. You are to provide service to the superiority. I have proper clearance and authorization to know anything you would tell me. Great. It was as I feared. I was trapped between the two of them. Do not be so concerned, Kuna said. They gave me another predatory smile. I asked you to do this, in part because I know you will be safe. As a Cytonic, you can hyperjump away at a moment's notice, should you be in danger. Yeah, about that, I said. How much should I admit? I won't have my ship, and I need the technology on it to hyperjump. Ah, Kuna said. So you're not fully trained yet. You still require mechanical aid. Exactly. Do you suppose you could give me some sort of training? Kuna shook their head. Untrained cytonics are far less dangerous than trained ones. It took centuries of training before our own cytonics were powerful enough to draw Delvers by accident. And we suspect your people are far from doing so. To train you would only accelerate that danger. Maybe if I had a superiority ship with a hyperdrive, I could try out using your technology, I said. Then I could see how it felt and learn how to do FTL safely.
Ooh,
Embot said in my ear. Nice. Well, I cannot keep you from experiencing a hyperjump, Kuna said. The training facility you'll visit today will require one. So perhaps you'd best pay attention to the process. Awesome. I checked the clock on my bracelet. Scud, it was almost time. Don't let me keep you, Kuna said with their ever-calm voice. Go prepare. You have a busy day ahead of you, one I'll be very interested to hear about. Right. Well, I couldn't exactly kick them out. I dashed to the stairwell, grabbing the package and passing the vacuuming Krell, who jumped back as I entered. I didn't buy the timid act. They were a spy, obviously. I walked a fine line in this game. In the bedroom, I quickly checked for anything I'd left that might expose who I really was. Then I changed into the flight suit that had been delivered, grabbed Doomslug from my room, and hurried up to Embot. Watch Doomslug, I said to him softly, tucking her into his cockpit. Kuna says I'll need to hyperjump to go to the training today. Will you be able to connect me? Your bracelet doesn't have a cytonic transmitter, Embot said. It's supposed to, but your people didn't have the right parts to fabricate one. So unless your new ship has one, and we can figure out how to link up, then no, we won't be able to talk once you hyperjump away. Great. I stored the destructor pistol. Keep watch for anything odd. And what do I do if I find something odd, Spensa? I can't escape. I don't know, I said, frustrated. I hated being so much in the power of others. If everything goes wrong, at least try to die heroically, all right? I have no response to that. How unusual. But here, I've got something for you. What? I asked. I'm uploading a second holographic map to your bracelet. If you use it, the image will make you look like a left dione of inconspicuous features, which I've constructed. It might be good to have a backup persona to adopt. I don't know that I can handle the one I already have, I said. Still, it is wise, just in case. You should get going. I'll still have contact with you up until you hyperjump, so we aren't going radio silent quite yet. I scrambled back down the steps to grab some breakfast, then pack a lunch as I'd been instructed. I put this in a backpack I'd ordered, then reached the bottom floor right in time for the chime to go off, informing me that the shuttle had arrived to take me to training. Kuna stood on the landing near the front door. Don't touch my ship, I said to them. I wouldn't think of doing so. I debated for a moment longer, suffering that untrustworthy smile, then sighed and marched out the door. Chapter 20. The shuttle was a small air car with an alien driver whose race I didn't recognize, though they looked vaguely fungoid in appearance. Embot would have been excited. I found the seat overly cushy. It was like those in Jorgen's luxury cars. I shook my head, strapping in as the shuttle took off. Rather than dwelling on the fact that I had to leave Embot behind, I watched the city beneath us, a seemingly endless expanse of buildings. Where are we going? I asked Embot, barely whispering so the shuttle's driver couldn't overhear. He piped up in my ear. The orders you received say you'll be transported to the Weights and Measures. Is that a ship? I asked. What an innocent-sounding name. Yes, a large trade vessel. It was obviously a cover. This Weights and Measures would be a military ship, just not one that the Superiority wanted the common people to know about. "Can we go over the different species I'll be flying with today?" I asked. I feel like Alanik would know something about them.
"That's actually a great idea," Embot said. "We wouldn't want you sounding more ignorant than you normally are. Let's see. Morimer is a Dione. You've got some experience with them by now. Though Morimer is what is known as a draft, their term for a person who is not yet born."
I shivered and turned to look out the window. "What they do feels like eugenics or something," I whispered. "They shouldn't be able to decide what personalities people are born with."
"That's a very human-centric way of looking at it," Embot said. "If you are to pull off this mission, you'll need to learn to see things from alien perspectives."
"I'll try," I whispered. "I'm most interested in the race they called Figments. What's the deal with them?"
"They are sapient beings who exist as a localized cloud of particulates in the air. Basically, they're smells."
"Talking smells?"
"Talking, thinking, and, from what I've read, somewhat dangerous smells," he answered. "They are not a large population, but are spoken of in hushed tones throughout the Superiority. Sources on the local data net insist that all remaining Figments, many died in the human wars and they are slow to reproduce, work as secret government operatives. Very little is known about them. Apparently, they usually investigate matters that involve internal Superiority politics, particularly the infractions of very high-ranking officials. They can pilot ships by infusing the electronics of the vehicle and interrupting, or spoofing, the electronic signals from the controls."
"Vapor did that in the test yesterday," I said. "She took over one of the drones and was flying it."
"So she just kind of flew over to it and seized control?"
"Exactly," Embot said.
"Or at least that's how people on the data net think it works. There is very little official data about Figments, but I can see why one showing up to the piloting test caused such a stir."
"So she's a spy too," I whispered. "An invisible spy."
"Who can survive in space," Embot said. "So they're not simply gaseous beings. Otherwise, the vacuum would rip them apart. It seems they can travel through space with no special equipment and can move at speed between ships. In the wars, they'd often infiltrate the mechanical portion of an enemy fighter and take control of it with the pilot still on board."
"Scud," I whispered, as if I didn't have enough to worry about.
"What about the human?" "There are very few like her. Most humans must remain in the preserves. If an official wants to remove one, the human must be licensed. Basically, someone has to take responsibility for them if they cause harm or damage."
"And do they?"
"Sometimes," Embot said. "I see more often a pattern of scapegoating and prejudice. Only government officials are supposed to keep humans, and then only for security or research purposes. I think the Superiority uses them in part because it likes the occasional reminder that they won the war."
I nodded to myself as we skimmed across the top of the city. I'd need to learn more about this sort of thing if I was going to recruit Braid. I wasn't certain I would need to do that, but I had to at least try to free her, right? I sighed and rubbed my forehead, trying to keep all of this straight. So I now separately had plans to steal a hyperdrive, rescue an enslaved human, and maybe find the secret to fighting the Delvers. Maybe I should just keep my mind on the main goal.
"Are you all right?" Embot asked. "Do you want me to stop?"
"No," I whispered. "I'm just feeling a little overwhelmed. At least the Kitson makes some kind of sense."
"That might be because of their history with humankind," Embot said. "Thousands of years ago, they made first contact with humans on Earth, before either society industrialized."
"How did that happen?"
"Cytonic teleportation doesn't require technology," Embot said. "As Kuna implied, if you can figure out how to use your powers, you'll be able to teleport yourself alone, and not just your ship."
Early psionics from the Kitson people ended up on Earth for reasons that now seem lost to time. There was trade and interaction between them and various regions of East Asia on Earth. Several Kitson cultures were directly influenced by Earth ones. The exchange happened until the Kitson psionics vanished. Vanished? It's a tragic story, Embot said. Though it should be noted that the Kitson were only a late Steel Age society then, so records might be untrustworthy. Apparently, their people did not trust the psionics, so the psionics left. Humans were part of this disagreement. A war is implied. The end result stranded the main population of Kitson on their homeworld for centuries until the superiority made contact. Huh, I whispered. Where did the Kitson psionics go? Nobody knows, he replied. All that remains are legends. Perhaps you should ask Hesho which one he believes. I'm more curious as to why the psionics would leave in the first place. Just because they weren't trusted? You didn't trust me when we first met, and I didn't leave. You can't leave, I said. I could sulk, he said. I have a sulking subroutine. Oh, I know. My shuttle flew down low, and we neared some docks that extended away from the city, out into the darkness. Just before we passed out of the airshell, however, I spotted a group of people waving signs. I couldn't read them. The distance was too great for my pin to translate for me. So I whispered to Embot. There's a group of people here waving signs, I said, right next to the docks. I squinted. An alien that looks like a gorilla is leading them. I think it's a Burl, the same species as the one who got kicked out of the flight test. Let me check the local news networks, Embot said. Just a moment. We flew past the demonstrators, and the shuttle carried me out of the air shield. I started to lift off my seat, my hair floating in zero G as we left the platform's gravitational field. We flew along the docks, most of which were filled with large craft of a size that couldn't land on launch pads. The stars came awake to me again, like a distant melody. The information that Starsight was sending through the nowhere to other planets. I tried to concentrate on the different sounds, but again, there were far too many of them. It was like a rushing river in the deep caverns. If I let the music sit in the back of my mind, I heard it as a simple tune, easy to ignore. But if I tried to pick out anything specific, it turned into a clatter. A part of me was surprised they let themselves use psionic communication at all. Yes, the superiority limited how much of it was used. Most people had to communicate with other worlds by sending letters that were loaded onto memory chips, then carried on starships and hooked up to local data nets when they finished traveling. However, the important people could use not just radio, but psionic communication through the nowhere. They had let me do it when sending a message to Alanik's homeworld. Found the reason for those protesters, Embot said. Apparently, the deaths at the test didn't go unnoticed. That pilot, Golza, who was ejected from the tests yesterday, is complaining vocally, with some support, about the way the superiority treats lesser species. Huh. That was more defiance than I'd expected. We approached the last ship on the docks, and its enormous size dwarfed our little shuttle. It was even larger than those battleships that threatened my home, with a multitude of ports along the sides, probably for launching starfighters. Those knobs on it are gun emplacements, I thought, though the guns were retracted for now. Which meant I was right. The weights and measures was very obviously a military vessel, a carrier ship. Seeing it made me worried. This ship was built to teleport places and then launch its fleet, which meant I probably wasn't going to be assigned a starfighter with its own hyperdrive. Still, I kept up hope as my shuttle flew in through a large open bay door that had an invisible shield holding in an atmosphere. Artificial gravity pulled me back into my seat, and we settled down on a launch pad in the wide chamber. Out the window, I spotted the first true military presence I'd seen on Starsight. Dions wearing naval uniforms and carrying sidearms were lined up awaiting us.
"You get out here,"
the driver announced, popping open the door.
"You're scheduled for pickup again at 9,000.
"All right," I said, climbing out. The air smelled sterile, a little like ammonia. Other shuttles were landing in the bay around me, letting out a steady stream of pilots. The 50 or so who had passed the test. As I was wondering what to do next, the shuttle next to me opened its doors, releasing a bunch of kitson. Today, the diminutive animal zoomed out on small platforms like flying plates, big enough to carry about 5 kitson each. Hesho himself hovered over to me, attended only by 2 kitson, a driver, and a kitson with a bright red and gold uniform, carrying what appeared to be an old, intricately carved metal shield. The pilot brought the plate up to eye level with me.
"Good morning, Captain Alanik,"
Hesho said from his podium at the center of the platform. "Captain Hesho," I said. "Did you sleep well?"
"Unfortunately, no," he said. "I was required to spend much of the sleep cycle engaged in political discourses, casting my votes in the planetary assembly of my people. Ha ha, politics is such a pain, is it not?"
I guess so. "Did the votes at least go your way?"
"No, I lost everyone,"
Hesho said.
"The rest of the assembly voted unanimously against my desires in each matter. What rotten luck. Ah, the indignities you must suffer when your people are a true democracy and not a shadow dictatorship ruled by an ancestral line of kings. Right?"
The other kitson flying past raised a cheer for democracy. Mormer walked over to join us, looking uncomfortable in their white superiority flight suit. Nearby, a group of 4 other pilots were led farther into the weights and measures.
"Have you seen our other 2 flight members?"
Hesho asked. "I haven't smelled vapor yet," Mormer said. "As for the human..." They seemed distinctly uncomfortable with the idea.
"I should like to see this one in person," Hesho said. "The legends speak of humans as giants who live in the mist and who feast upon the bodies of the dead."
"I've seen several," Mormer said. "They weren't any bigger than I am. Most were smaller, actually. But there was something off about them, something dangerous. I'd recognize the sensation again in an instant." A small drone, not unlike one of the kitson flying platforms, hovered over to us.
"Ah,"
a voice said from a speaker in it. It sounded like one of the officials we'd met yesterday.
"Flight 15, excellent. No stragglers?"
"We're missing 2 members," I said.
"No,"
a voice said from the air next to me.
"Just 1.
I jumped. So vapor was here. I hadn't smelled cinnamon, just that ammonia scent, which faded to cinnamon almost immediately. Scud, how long had she been watching? Had she been in the shuttle with me?
"The human will join you at a later time, Flight 15,
the official instructed us.
"You are to report to Jump Room 6. I'll show you."
The remote-controlled drone buzzed off, so we followed. Before we reached the door from the shuttle drop-off bay to the interior, we were stopped by a pair of guards armed with destructor rifles, who looked through our bags and then waved us onward.
"Flight 15?
I asked the others as we stepped into a hallway. "Not exactly punchy, is it? Can we choose something else?"
"I like it being a number," Mormer said. "It's simple, easy to record, and easy to remember."
"Nonsense,"
Hesho said from his platform to my right.
"I agree with Captain Alanik. A number won't do. I shall call us the Flowers of Night's Last Kiss."
"That is exactly what I was talking about," Mormer said. "How could we say that mouthful in context, Hesho?"
"Nobody will write poetry about Flight 15,
Hesho said.
"You shall see, Captain Mormer. Bestowing proper names is one of my talents. If destiny had not chosen me for my current service, I surely would have been a poet."
"A warrior poet?" I said. "Like an old earth scald,
Precisely, Hesho said, raising a furry fist to me. I raised one back, grinning. We joined several other groups of pilots being led down the hallway. Those flights had been sorted by species. Many had only one species represented, and a handful had two species mixed. Ours was the only one I saw that had more than two different races represented. Hesho's people have a history with humans, I thought, and so do Alanik's. Vapors people fought in the wars. Maybe we'd been chosen specifically because we might be able to deal with Braid. More soldiers stood watch along this hallway, a pair of Krell this time, wearing full armor instead of just the ordinary sandstone carapace. As we passed them, I realized I hadn't seen any lesser species in this carrier, save for us pilots. All the guards and officials we passed were Krell or Dions. It left me wondering, why did they need us pilots again? They fought my people on Detritus with remote-controlled drone ships. No, I thought. If I can hear the instructions sent to the drones, the Delver will be able to as well. They needed a force of pilots trained in the cockpit. Embot, I whispered, intending to ask if he'd found out anything about the remote drone programs the Superiority used. My earpiece returned only static at that. Scud. Had something happened to him? My heart started racing until I realized I was inside a military ship. They must have communications shielding in place. Either that or I'd simply gotten beyond the bracelet's communication range already. I was truly on my own. We were led through some corridors with featureless metallic walls and vivid red carpet down the center. We arrived at an intersection and the drone turned right, toward a corridor lined with rooms. The rest of my flight turned to follow, but I hesitated at the intersection. Right? Why were we turning right? I knew, logically, that there was no reason for me to be confused, and yet some piece of me reached out, looking farther down the hallway we'd been traveling. Not right at the intersection, but straight ahead. That was the way to go. I could feel something up there.
What do you think you're doing?
Barked a soldier guarding the intersection. I froze in place, realizing I'd started to walk down the hallway. I looked up at the writing on the wall and my translator helpfully piped out the meaning. Restricted area, engineering and engines. I blushed and turned right instead, hurrying to catch up with the others. The guard watched me until the group of us turned into one of the rooms off the corridor. I felt, before I arrived, that Braid was inside. And indeed, I stepped in to find her sitting alone in the little chamber, which contained a half dozen jump seats. Braid wore the same sharp white flight suit we all wore, and sat in the back row, buckled in, looking out the window.
So that's her, Hesho said, hovering near my head. She doesn't look so dangerous. Still, a blade that has slain 100 men may not shine like one freshly forged. Danger, sweet like a forbidden perfume. I will know thee.
That was beautiful, Hesho, I said.
Thank you, he said.
The other Kitson flew into the room, chattering together. The drone that had been leading us indicated we should strap in and wait for further instructions, then left.
Strap in? Hesho asked. I thought we'd be assigned our starfighters.
We likely will, Mortimer said, taking a seat. Once the weights and measures carries us to the training location, a specialized facility several light years away.
Hesho said. I assumed we'd have hyperdrive-capable starships, so we could fly there ourselves.
I'll admit, I said, I was hoping the same.
Oh, they'd never give us individual ships capable of hyperjumps, Mortimer said. That kind of technology is dangerous. It's never trusted to lesser races. Misusing it could draw the attention of the Delvers upon us.
We're learning to fight the Delvers, I said.
It still wouldn't be wise, Mortimer said. FTL jumps are always handled by highly trained expert technicians who have prime intelligence. Even special classification species, like figments, aren't allowed. Right, Vapor?
I jumped as she spoke from just behind me.
This is correct.
Scud. I was never going to get used to having an invisible person in our flight.
Some races have cytonics, I said, sitting down and strapping in. They don't need superiority ships to hyperjump.
Letting a cytonic teleport a ship is incredibly dangerous, Mortimer said, making an odd hand gesture, a kind of swiping motion.
A Dione indication of dismissiveness, maybe?
Going back to cytonics would be like returning to ancient combustion engines instead of using acclivity rings. No, no. In modern society, we would never use a method so foolhardy. Our FTL jumps are extremely safe and never draw Delver attention.
Curious, I glanced at Braid, but she didn't look back at me. Embot's research had reinforced what Kuna had told me. The modern people of the Superiority knew about cytonics, but the bulk of the population believed there were none left among them. It likely wouldn't be known that Braid was one, let alone that I was one too.
So, could it be possible that this phantom FTL technology the Superiority had was all just a lie? They claimed to have something safe to use, but what if that was just an excuse to control and suppress knowledge of cytonics?
I closed my eyes, listening to the stars as Gran-Gran had always taught. I felt the weights and measures finally start moving, unhooking from the dock and accelerating slowly away from Starsight. Those were physical sensations and seemed distant, disconnected. The stars, the cytonic communications. I tried to parse them, understand them. I tried the exercise my grandmother had taught me, pretending I was flying, rising, soaring through space. I could hear something. Something close. Louder. More demanding. Prepare for hyperjump. Orders from the captain of this ship passed down to the engine room. I could feel it there. And the hyperdrive. There was something familiar about it. I heard the captain order the jump. I waited, watching, feeling what was going on, trying to absorb the process. My mind flooded with information. A location. The place we were going. I knew it immediately. I could... A voice screamed from somewhere nearby. Then the ship suddenly entered the nowhere.
Chapter 21. I was there, hanging in the not place, surrounded by blackness. And the eyes, they were here. Except they weren't looking at me. I saw them, sensed them, heard them, but their gaze didn't find me. They were focused elsewhere, as if looking toward the source of the scream. Yes, that was it. The piercing, agonized scream lingered in my mind. It distracted the Delvers from seeing the weights and measures as it slipped through the nowhere. It was over like a snap of the fingers. I lurched back into my seat in the little room, grunting. I felt as if I'd been thrown physically, then been caught by the chair. I groaned, sagging forward.
Captain Alanik, Hesho asked, hovering nearby. Are you well?
I looked around the jump room, which held only the members of my flight. Mortimer didn't seem to have even noticed that moment in the nowhere. I looked back at Braid. She met my eyes, then narrowed them at me. She knew I was cytonic. Did she suspect I was human as well? I had a moment of panic and looked down at my hands, but they were still a light violet shade, indicating that my disguise was functioning.
Welcome, everyone.
A voice came over the PA system. It was Winzik.
We've arrived at our training facility. This is going to be so exciting. Yes, indeed. You probably have many questions. A drone will lead you to your flight dock, and you can get your starfighter assignments.
We're here?
Hesho asked.
We hyperjumped? Usually they give some kind of warning before it happens.
The door of our jump room opened and he zipped out, the other Kitson tagging along behind on their platforms. The rest of us, including Braid, gathered outside in the hallway, then followed a drone that had arrived to lead us. Another drone chased after the Kitson, barely keeping up with them. I looked toward the engine room. That direction, I thought. The scream came from that direction. This technology was no sham. Superiority FTL drives did let them hide. The Delvers hadn't seen us. It felt even more vital to me than ever that I find a way to steal a hyperdrive. My people needed this technology. At the same time, I had the striking suspicion that whatever was driving this ship, it wasn't technology in the traditional sense. There was something too familiar about it. Something.
What did you sense?
A curious voice asked beside me. I stiffened, smelling cinnamon. I tried with some effort to keep myself from squirming at Vapor's presence as I walked after the rest of my team. If I smelled her, did that mean I was breathing her in?
To most people, a hyperjump is imperceptible, Vapor said, speaking with her breezy voice. Not to you. Curious.
Why does the superiority risk using cytonic communications? I blurted out. Perhaps the wrong thing to say to change the subject, but it had been on my mind. Everyone is so scared of Delvers, but we blatantly use communication that might draw their attention. Vapor sent change to one that was slightly minty. Was that intentional on her part? Or was it like how a human changed moods?
It's been over 100 years since the last Delver attack, she said. It's easy to grow lax in the face of that. Besides, cytonic communication was never actually enough to draw a Delver into our realm.
But
if a Delver has already come to our realm, then they might hear that communication and follow it. They can hear all wireless signals, radio included, though cytonic communication is the most attractive to them. In the past, wise empires learned to hide their communication, but these days it can be employed very cautiously, assuming no Delver is nearby, assuming nobody has been brash enough to draw them into our realm by cytonic travel or by dangerous use of AI.
Her scent receded. I followed the drone, not trusting myself to answer. I'd come here with the goal of stealing a hyperdrive, but my task was suddenly far more daunting. I couldn't just run off with a small starfighter. If I wanted a hyperdrive, I'd have to hijack this entire carrier ship. Was there an easier way? If I could only see what was going on in that engine room, maybe I could put together the secret.
Scud! I wished Rig were here with me.
He'd be able to figure all of this out, I was sure. I followed the others to a different dock from the one where we'd arrived. Here, groups of starfighters were being prepped for the flights to use in today's training. They were boxier than the sleek DDF ones, but I didn't spare them much attention at first, because something magnificent hung outside. An enormous polyhedral structure dominated the view through the invisible shield that held the air in the bay. It was big enough to dwarf our carrier ship. It was as large as a space station.
Welcome, pilots, Winzik said over the PA, to the Delver maze.
I stepped up to the shield separating us from the vacuum. We hung in space, orbiting a fairly weak star. The huge structure seemed to bend to my eyes, as if I could barely comprehend it. Sweeping lines, gradations in the darkness. This metallic structure wasn't quite a sphere, but a dodecahedron with smooth faces and sharp edges. I smelled cinnamon. Then a quiet voice beside me said,
It's insane that they actually built one.
What is it? I asked.
A training ground, Vapor said. How did she make sounds to talk? For recreating a battle against a Delver. The humans built this years ago, and we've only just located it. They knew.
Knew what? Vapor's scent changed to something sharper,
the smell of wet metal after machinery is sprayed down.
They knew that eventually the Delvers would need to be faced. Our fear of them stunts our communication, our travel, even our warfare. Break free of that hold, and the galaxy is yours.
Her smell faded away. I remained in place, thinking on that until Hesho came flying over.
Incredible, he said. Come, Captain Alanik. We've been assigned ships. They cannot hyperjump, but they look suitable for fighting.
I followed him to our line of five fighters. They were painted stark white and didn't have true wings. They looked like triangular wedges of steel with cockpits up front and weapons installed on the slant of each side of the wedge. They obviously weren't meant for atmospheric battle. The Kitson fighter was about 50% larger than the others and had been built like a battleship, with many small gun emplacements. The Kitson were thrilled with this, chattering as they went over the specs and made assignments. It apparently had multiple stations inside and various departments to work. My ship was an interceptor built for speed, with moderate firepower in the form of twin destructors, and, I was pleased to note, a single light lance turret underneath. I'd worried I wouldn't have one of those, and most of the ships didn't. Apparently, the superiority officials had seen how effectively I'd used mine in the test. Mortimer had an interceptor too, while Vapor had been given a sniper with a longer range gun but no light lance. I looked over my shoulder, noting Braid walking to the last of the fighters, a third interceptor, also with a light lance. I stepped over to her as she reached her ship. She looked up, startled. What? She demanded. I just wanted to welcome you to the flight, I said, holding out my hand. I nodded toward it. It's a human gesture, I've been told. I wouldn't know, she said. I don't associate with monsters. She brushed past me, then hauled herself up the ladder into her ship. Scud. How brainwashed was she? If I was going to recruit her, I'd need to find a way to talk to her more without raising anyone else's suspicions. For now, it seemed my only option was to start training. And to be honest, I found I was eager to begin. All of this imitation and subterfuge was exhausting. It would be good to just fly again. I climbed into my fighter and was pleased to find that the controls were familiar. Had we humans gotten these designs from aliens long ago? Or had our attempt to conquer the galaxy spread our technology throughout it? Embot, I said. Pre-flight check. Silence. Right. Being without his friendly voice made me feel suddenly exposed. I'd grown accustomed to having him there in the ship's computer, watching out for me. With a sigh, I found a pre-flight checklist under the seat, used my pin to translate it, then went through the steps to double-check that everything worked the way I expected. This is Alanik, I said, after testing the communications. Everyone online?
This is the Kitson Unity ship. Swims against the current in a stream reflecting the sun, Hesho's voice said. Recently named. All systems operational. This ship even has a very nice captain's chair.
We should pick call signs, I said. I'll be Spring. Do we have to? Mortimer said. Our names are simple enough, aren't they? It's a military thing, I said. Mortimer, you can be call sign Complains. Oh, Mortimer said, their voice sounding despondent. I guess I deserve that. Scud. Assigning an insulting nickname wasn't nearly as fun when someone just accepted it.
Call signs aren't required, Braid said. I will use my name, which is Braid. Do not call me by something else.
Fine, I said.
Vapor, you there?
Yes, her quiet voice said. But my normal mission call sign is top secret, so I will need another.
The wind that mingles with a man's dying breath, Hesho suggested.
That's very specific, Mortimer said.
Yeah, I said. It's cool, but kind of a mouthful, Hesho.
I think it's beautiful, Vapor said.
Flight 15,
a voice said from command. Be ready to launch. Command out.
Wait, I said to the voice. What's our command structure? How should we organize ourselves?
It doesn't matter to us, the voice said. Figure it out yourself. Command out.
That's annoying, I said over the private line to my flight. I thought the superiority knew more about military discipline than that.
Maybe not, Hesho said. They did need to recruit us as pilots.
They have hundreds of other pilots flying remote drones, I said. Surely they have command structures, officers and ranks. Mormor cleared their throat over a line.
My left parent did a stint as a drone pilot and, well, most of them retire after a short time. The duty is too stressful, too aggressive.
Scud. Well, that was probably another big reason why we on Detritus had survived so long. Flight command ordered us to lift off, and the five of us rose on our acclivity rings, then maneuvered out of the weights and measures docks into the deepness of space. The distant star shined light that reflected in bright waves off the metallic surface of the maze. Its awesome size reminded me of the platforms around Detritus. Both must have taken extraordinary amounts of effort to create. We flew out to our instructed coordinates to wait. I tore my attention away from the maze and hit my flight chatter button. We simply couldn't go into training without some kind of command structure. Hesho, I said, do you want to be our flight leader? You've got command experience.
Not much, Hesho said. I have been a ship captain for only about 3 weeks, Captain Alanik. Before that, I was in politics.
You were absolute monarch of a small section of the Kitson home planet, Vapor said softly.
Details, Hesho said. Who cares about those dark ages, right? We're enlightened now.
He hesitated.
But it was not small. We encompassed over a third of the planet. Regardless, I do not think it would be wise for me to command this flight. I should not divide my attention from commanding my crew while this ship is unfamiliar and my people are still learning it.
You can take command if you want, Alanik, Mormor said to me.
I grimaced. No, please. I'm likely to charge into a black hole or something. You don't want one of your interceptors to be in command. Vapor, you should be flight leader.
Me?
The quiet voice asked.
That sounds good to me, Mormor said. Alanik is right. We shouldn't have someone who is too aggressive.
I accept this decision, Hesho said. As our sniper, Vapor can survey the battlefield and be in the best position to make decisions.
You all barely know me, Vapor protested, which was part of the reason I'd suggested it.
Maybe if Vapor was our flight leader, she'd be forced to interact with the rest of us. And maybe I'd be less likely to forget she was around. I still didn't quite understand her purpose here.
Braid, I asked, what do you think? I am not allowed to vote in such matters, she said.
Great.
All right, Vapor, the job is yours. Good luck.
Very well, she said. I suppose everyone should give me a flight status check then.
I smiled. That sounded very much like she had some combat experience, so I was learning about her already. It seemed that call signs were out, though, as everyone just used their names as they called in. I reluctantly did likewise, as wrong as it felt. I didn't want to act like I had too much experience with this sort of thing. Vapor organized us into a default flight pattern, with me and Braid flying up front, Hesho in the center, and Mormor and herself flying in the anchor position. Then, at my suggestion, we did a few formation exercises while we waited for instructions. As we did, I acknowledged to myself that perhaps it made sense for the superiority to let each group make their own command structure. After all, most of the other flights contained only one species. Different cultures might have different ways of looking at military service. The fact that we had an entire crew of Kitson on one ship was evidence of that. Still, it grated on me. It felt like the superiority was being lazy. They wanted flights of fighters, but didn't want to have to deal with the hassle of truly commanding them. It was a lukewarm, half-in, half-out measure. After the sharply defined rules of the DDF, this felt like a sloppy mess.
Eventually, Winzik called us on the general line. All right, everyone. Welcome, and thank you for your service. We at the Department of Protective Services are very excited to be training this new bold force. You will be our first line of defense against a danger that has loomed above the superiority for its entire existence. We have prepared a quick video orientation for you to watch. This should explain your goal here. Please experience the orientation and save questions until the end. Thank you again.
A video orientation? I said over the channel to my flight.
The Superiority has a lot of graphic designers and animators, Mortimer said. It's one of the most common professions chosen by those who wish to work beyond basic subsistence.
I frowned. What's a graphic designer?
The canopy of my fighter suddenly lit up with a holographic projection. It wasn't as good as one of M-Bot's. This one was somewhat insubstantial, and the depth was off. But the effect was still awe-inspiring, because it was showing me a Delver. It looked like the one I'd seen back on the recording at Detritus, an enormous, oppressive shadow within a cloud of light and dust. Chunks of burning asteroids spewed from it, leaving trails in the void. They churned past my canopy, and though I knew this was just a hologram, my fingers twitched on the controls of my ship. Every instinct I had was screaming at me to get away from this terror, this impossible, incredible monstrosity. It would destroy me and everything I loved. I could feel it.
This is a Delver,
a perky feminine voice said. A cutesy graphic surrounded the thing on the screen, a shimmering line of stars and lightning bolts.